So we will be discussing an overview of the Bhagavad Gita over the next few days. We will probably not be able to complete it in this visit, but we will be taking it probably in maybe 25 classes. We'll try to take one chapter per class. So we won't go too much into the details, but we will try to get an overall flow to understand what is happening in the Bhagavad Gita. Some chapters like chapter 2 and chapter 18 are especially long, 72 and 78 verses. So some 55 verses are there in the 11th chapter. So some chapters may take a little more time. So whenever next you come for classes, all of you can bring your Gita with you. And before we start in this with the verses of the Gita, let's understand the context of the Gita in the Vedic tradition. We know among the six schools of philosophy, Vedanta is the most respected and influential. And in Vedanta, there is, if one wants to explain one's philosophy, there are three foundational sources of knowledge, or three books. They are called the Prasthanatraya. So Prasthanatraya is Shruti, Smriti and Nyaya, or it is the Upanishads, the Bhagavad Gita and the Vedanta Sutra. That means every Acharya, whether it is Shankaracharya or Ramanucharya or Madhvacharya or Parasampradaya Valde Vidyabhushan, if we want to establish the philosophy of that particular Acharya, that Acharya has to explain how the philosophy is based on and consistent with these texts. Now these texts are the Upanishads. Now Upanishads, there are 108 Upanishads. Out of that, Muktik Upanishad described 10 as major Upanishads, most important Upanishads. And among them, the Isha Upanishad comes first in that list. So there are the Upanishads, then there is the Vedanta Sutra, and then there is the Bhagavad Gita. Now among these three books also, the Bhagavad Gita is special, because often the Upanishads are not in themselves, or a single Upanishad in itself is not a complete body of knowledge. For example, if we study the Isha Upanishad without studying the purports of Srila Prabhupada, probably we can read the Isha Upanishad in 15 minutes and will not understand anything in 15 years. Because it's not complete in itself. There may be some level of completeness in some of the Upanishads, but often several of the Upanishads have to be studied in completeness, in context, in relation to understand what the Upanishads are saying. So many of them are very brief. Of course, Brihadaranyaka Upanishad is very big. The name itself is Brihad. But generally the Upanishads are quite small. So one Upanishad does not give a complete philosophical understanding. On the other hand, the Vedanta Sutra, it is much bigger, around 1000 verses, but it is very, very terse. Terse means extremely brief. And what each verse means is liable to enormous amount of interpretations. And compared to this, the Bhagavad Gita is complete in itself. There are enormous amount of concepts packed in it. At the same time, it is not very large. It is only 700 verses. And in fact, the Sanskrit of the Bhagavad Gita is relatively easier. Although there are some words like Brahman or Atma, which can be interpreted in various ways, but in general, the Sanskrit of the Bhagavad Gita is relatively easy. In fact, when the Westerners came to India, when they wanted to learn Sanskrit, to understand Sanskrit as a basic book to read when you are beginning to learn Sanskrit, they would use two books. One was the Hitopadesh and the other was the Bhagavad Gita. That means the Sanskrit language can be learned by studying the Bhagavad Gita. So Sanskrit is relatively easy. In general, in the Itihasas, whether it is Ramayana and Mahabharata, the Sanskrit is relatively easy. And of course, Bhagavad Gita Sanskrit is slightly more elegant than the Mahabharata Sanskrit. But in general, it is similar. So it is also accessible in that sense. And that's why, along with the Bible and the Tao Te Ching of China, Bhagavad Gita is the most translated book in the world. And of course, it is more than the Bible and the Tao Te Ching, it is the most commented. So, in that sense, the Bhagavad Gita has had a lot of importance traditionally. And especially during the independence time, because the Christians were distributing their Bible, and the Hindu leaders wanted one book which could in a compact way present the Indian philosophy or the Vedic Hindu philosophy. So they found that book most suitable to be the Bhagavad Gita. So the Bhagavad Gita was very important and influential among the intellectuals for a long, long millennia. But for the masses, they can't understand the Upanishads, they can't understand the Vedanta Sutra, they can't understand the Bhagavad Gita also to a large extent. So for them, spirituality was accessible primarily to the Itihasas and the Puranas. The Ramayana, Mahabharata, and among the Puranas, the Bhashyamad Bhagavatam is the most important. It's not just Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's opinion, but in general, there are practically among the 18 Puranas, the Bhagavatam has had more than 70 commentaries written on it. Whereas other Puranas, many of them don't even have one or two commentaries written. So that's why the Bhagavatam is important. So for the mass reach, the Bhagavad Gita became a tool, especially in the pre-independence period. But unfortunately, most people knew the Bhagavad Gita was sacred. They didn't know what the Bhagavad Gita is all about. Because it is philosophical. And that's why it was liable to a lot of misinterpretations. As of now, the oldest commentary on the Bhagavad Gita that is available in the Vedic tradition is by Shankaracharya. Some earlier ones might be there somewhere in manuscript form, but not many. Then, Ramanacharya wrote his commentary Gita Bhashya, and he strongly countered the Advaitic understanding of Shankaracharya. Of course, Ramacharya's main polemic means criticism of Shankaracharya comes in his Sri Bhashya, Vedanta Sutra. His Bhagavad Gita is relatively simpler, it's more direct. There are not many arguments and refutations and counter-refutations that he reserves for the Sri Bhashya. Madhvacharya did not comment on the Bhagavad Gita itself, but he wrote on the Bhagavad Gita extensively in different places, and all that has been compiled together and made into like his, not commentary, gloss on the Bhagavad Gita. Gloss means it's like a selective commentary. In our sampradaya, the Goswamis did not refer much to the Bhagavad Gita, although they quoted occasionally. The first known commentary in our sampradaya is by Vishnuvath Chakravarti Thakur. Of course, Sridhar Swami also wrote a commentary, the Subodhini, but that is, Sridhar Swami is not exactly in our sampradaya. He was accepted as authority because he was a Vaishnava in a Mayavad sampradaya. So in our sampradaya means starting from Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Chakravarti Pad wrote his Bhavartha Darshini. Then immediately Baldev Vidya Bhushan wrote his Gita Bhushan. So generally the disciple does not comment on the same book as the spiritual master. But Baldev Vidya Bhushan had to establish Gaudiya Vaishnava philosophy based on the Prasthanatraya. And that's why he commented on the book, and his commentary is quite distinct from Chakravarti Pad's commentary. Chakravarti Pad's commentary is more rasic. We will refer to their commentaries in our overview. Baldev Vidya Bhushan's commentary is more analytical and philosophical. Then Bhaktivinoda Thakur wrote two brief glosses on the Bhagavad Gita, which have been compiled together and made into what is his commentary, but it's not on all verses. And of course, Srila Prabhupada considered this book to be foundational for his preaching work. And it said that he wrote one commentary which got lost when he was in India. And he wrote a second commentary, which is what is available to us. And among Prabhupada's disciples, several devotees have written further. In fact, Prabhupada wanted himself to write another commentary on the Gita. Prabhupada's commentary follows mostly Ramanujacharya and Baldev Vidya Bhushan, their commentary. Prabhupada dedicates his commentary to Baldev Vidya Bhushan, and he quotes extensively from Ramacharya's commentary, especially 2.12 Matvevaham Jatunasam, that is almost like a replica of Ramacharya's commentary. So this is the context from the historical point of view within the Hindu tradition and within the Vedic tradition and within the Gaudiya tradition. Now the Bhagavad Gita comes in the sixth book of the Mahabharata, the Bhishma Parva. It is from chapters 25 to 41. 42. Chapters 25 to 42 in the sixth book, the Bhishma Parva. So, in this Parva, as we know, both the armies are assembled for the battle. Actually, the Mahabharata has a slightly interesting way. Sanjay is actually on the battlefield and he comes back and he tells Bhishma has fallen. And Dhritarashtra says, how did Bhishma fall? How is it possible? So, on the 10th day, actually the narration starts. So, the narration of the events in the Mahabharata battlefield by Sanjay to Arjuna start from the 10th. So, he first discusses, Bhishma has fallen. How did it happen? Please tell me everything. And then he goes back from the how the armies assemble on the battlefield and how they start fighting. So the Bhishma Parva is extremely long in the Mahabharata. So there in chapter 25, he starts speaking about the Bhagavad Gita. So the first chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, now obviously when Krishna and Arjuna were speaking, you know, they were not, you know, Krishna would not say, Ataha Dvitiyo Adhyayaha. No, it was a natural flow that was going on. So Vyasadeva, while writing it down, divided it into sections. Now Srila Prabhupada, the names that he gave to the chapters, some of the names he gave by his own, some of the names he has taken from the standard, what is the Gita Press Gorakhpur, and some of them he has taken from our Acharyas. So we'll discuss that also. So the first chapter has two basic sections. There are 46 verses in the first chapter. And the first 26 verses are describing Arjuna's observing the armies in the battlefield. So that is called as Sainya Niriksha Yoga. And Prabhupada takes that as the name of the title. Another name for this chapter is also based on the second section. That is Lamentation of Arjuna. So Arjuna Vishada Yoga. Now, before we start actually going into the verses, Srila Prabhupada strongly contested, refuted the metaphorical understanding of the Bhagavad Gita. Mainly because the metaphorical was used to do away with the implications of the literal. That means the idea that there was no war in which so many millions of people were killed, and actually this is all an analogy meant to teach us some lessons. That was the implication especially brought out by Gandhi. And Prabhupada was very passionate in his refutation of, in his condemnation of this. Now that does not mean that the Bhagavad Gita cannot be understood metaphorically. The important thing is the metaphorical understanding should not be a substitute for the literal understanding. The metaphorical understanding can be an addition to the literal understanding. So Madhvacharya describes that the itihasas can be understood at three levels. The literal, the ethical and the metaphorical. The literal means events have happened as they have happened actually. And just by hearing the events, we become, because it's all connected with Krishna, we become purified. So we don't have to analyze, we don't have to contextualize, we don't have to do anything, just hear. Just by the recitation we will become purified. That's at one level. But another level is ethical. Ethical means moral. We can learn how, when we are faced with crisis in our life, what are the things that we can learn? You know, should we behave like this or like this? For example, you know, we learn from the example of Karna that loyalty is very good. But loyalty to an evil person is very bad. So now, this particular lesson may not be directly stated in the Mahabharata. But that's an ethical lesson which we draw from it. And in fact, Prabhupada does it all the time in the Bhagavatam purports. You know, he says, For example, he says, Draupadi is Vama Svabhava. She's soft-hearted. And that's why he doesn't want he wants Ashwatthama to be insulted, to be punished or something like that. So Prabhupada draws inferences which we can apply in our life. That's ethical. Now metaphorical means that the Bhagavad Gita does represent the battle within our consciousness. There are innumerable selfish material desires represented by the Kauravas, and there are few noble desires, spiritual desires represented by the Pandavas. So Raghunath Maharaj, both in his book Journey Home, he talks about this. And once he was in Kurukshetra, when the temple was to be, a cornerstone was being laid over there, that time he gave a whole lecture on this, how the Bhagavad Gita can be understood at this level also. But actually, our life is like a battle, and the battle is not so much external, it's internal. So we have to fight this battle, and Arjuna's guide and Krishna's guidance can help us to win this internal battle. In fact, there is this, you know, the Satanic Verses was a book written by Salman Rushdie, talking about several of the verses in the Quran which talk a lot about violence. For example, there's 9.4 in the Quran which says, "Kill the kafirs wherever you see them." So there's no qualification there. Just kill them wherever you see them. So there was one Hindu who got converted to Islam, and he wrote a book called Satanic Verses from the Gita. So all these things keep going on. And he said the Gita is a book of violence. But if you look at it historically, you know, the Hindus, even whatever society considers culturally or religiously to be Hindus, they are not known to be very violent. It's only in a response to hundreds of attacks on them that one attack might come. And certainly when the Hindus are violent, it's not based on the Bhagavad Gita. It's just based on sectarian passion. But the Bhagavad Gita primarily talks about a war within our consciousness. And for winning that war within our consciousness, certain culture is conducive and certain culture is detrimental. So those who disrupt the external culture that is conducive to establish the internal culture, against them Krishna tells you have to fight a war. So it is not so much that every follower of the Bhagavad Gita has to fight a war. There was one commenter who wrote on the Bhagavad Gita. One Indian politician. He said, you know, Indians, if only they had followed Bhagavad Gita, India's history would have been so much different. How? He says, if Indians wanted to follow Bhagavad Gita, they should attack Pakistan and remove Pakistan from the map of the world. You know, that is the following of the Bhagavad Gita. Now, that has got nothing to do. If as a matter of political expediency that is required, that's required. But that's not a matter of philosophical necessity, philosophical implication from the Gita. The point here is that the Bhagavad Gita primarily talks that we have to win the war in our consciousness. The godly desires have to triumph over the demoniac desires. And there is certain culture which is conducive for this, and certain culture which is detrimental to this. So those who are demoniac and who are determined to be demoniac, and those who are going to make others demoniac, against them, in exceptional situations, a war has to be fought. So the primary message of the Bhagavad Gita is not war, external war. The primary message of the Bhagavad Gita is internal transformation. So in fact, you know, before Arjuna makes a war with the Kauravas, he makes peace with Krishna. He makes peace with Krishna. How do we make peace with Krishna? By becoming harmonious with Krishna. Karishye vachinam tava. So actually the cause of all the sufferings in this world is that we are making war with Krishna. Now Krishna has a plan and we have our own plan. And the conflict of that is the root of all problems. So the Bhagavad Gita is essentially a message neither about war, neither about peace. It is a message about harmony with God. And when we are harmonious with God, sometimes it may require war, but most often it requires surrender, obedience, devotion, service, selflessness, which are the qualities that the Bhagavad Gita actually emphasizes. Now, of course, Prabhupada also explained that the Bhagavad Gita is placed in a more very dramatic way at the center of the Bhagavad Gita, at the climactic moment in the Mahabharata, so that people's eyes, ears and hearts will be opened to receive the philosophy. And of course that also refers, that also implies that the Bhagavad Gita is a book, it's like a emergency scripture. Emergency scripture means it's a book that offers a philosophical solution to a practical problem. Sometimes people think, you know, for practical problems we need to have practical solutions. And philosophy is when you are relaxed and you have no practical problem, then you can study philosophy. No, there is a philosophical solution to a serious practical problem. So in that sense, the Bhagavad Gita is not talking about some arbitrary philosophy which, you know, some guru and some disciple will sit under a forest in a tree and they have all day to sit and discuss philosophy. It's not like that. Bhagavad Gita is in a very practical context. And in that sense, it's relevant to all of us. So, let's go over the verses now. Can I have one Bhagavad Gita? Thank you. So, we may not read all the translations. I'll just explain what is happening. And some translations and some sections of purport we'll read. So, as we know, Dhritarashtra starts the Bhagavad Gita. Very interesting. Not Sri Bhagavanu Vacha, it's Dhritarashtra Vacha. There are three speakers in the Gita. Dhritarashtra, Arjuna, four speakers. Dhritarashtra, Arjuna, Krishna and Sanjaya. So, Dhritarashtra is asking, what happened on the battlefield? So, Kurukshetra is the place where a lot of holy things have happened in the past. There was a king Kuru who did a lot of tapasya. And when he got blessings from the devatas and the Lord, he asked one of the blessings, at the place where I did tapasya, let it be considered very holy. Then Parashuram also did his austerities over there, his atonement for having killed 21 generations of Kshatriyas. And that's why, actually, that incident which is described in chapters 82 and 83 of the 10th canto, and the gopis meeting Krishna in Kurukshetra, that happens before the battle. So although it comes towards the end, the Bhagavatam till chapters around 55 is chronological. After that, it becomes more thematic rather than chronological. So the Battle of Kurukshetra is described later in the chapter in chapter 75 to 80, something like that. But this chapter comes later. So that meeting happens over there. So because it was considered a very holy place, that's why all of them came into solar eclipse at the time of the solar eclipse there. Now, because of the place being very holy, it's interesting that even when a war is to be fought, you know, it's not like, you know, like Pakistan suddenly attacks somewhere, you know, Kargil or somewhere, you attack and the enemy is sleeping or enemy is not alert. You know, actually, a war is to be fought, it's fought on, you designate, okay, this is the place we will fight, and you assemble from this side, we'll assemble from this side, and the war is fought like a match. You know, if there's a, you decide a pitch, you don't play cricket on the, in the home of somebody. You have to have a cricket match, you designate a place for that, and then you designate a time for that, and everybody comes prepared. So, war in that sense is like a sport for Kshatriyas. So, that's why it's fought according to rules, and although killing may seem very, very bloody for us, but from the spiritual point of view, when people understand that even after death we will go to heaven, they are not so fearful of that. So that place was designated. This is where we will have the war. And then both the armies assembled. And then they are about to start the war. So Dhritarashtra is fearful that because of the holy place, it may affect his sons in a negative way. And they may think, oh, I will become peaceful. So therefore he is apprehensive. Therefore he asks, what happened? Please tell me, what happened? So, and from the second verse, Sanjay starts describing, and he says, it's a little illogical question, as all of you know. After my son, Mamakaha Pandavashayo, Kimakurvata Sanjayo. So he says, Dhritarashtra Kurukshetra, Samaveta Yudhsava. They assembled for fighting, and then what did they do? So that question itself indicates his uncertainty. It's like, you know, after this class, all of us sit down for taking Mahaprasad, and then he asks, what did you do? So it doesn't make much sense, but it indicates his nervousness. And then Sainya Niriksha Yoga is starting. So the whole thing is described initially from Duryodhana's perspective. Duryodhana is observing the battle. And he describes that Duryodhana came up to Dronacharya. Now, initially, on both sides, the commander, here was Bhishma, and there was Drishtadyumna. Drishtadyumna was made the commander because Arjuna, although he was the most expert, Arjuna could be kept free for the actual fight. Because Arjuna was an excellent warrior, and if he has to do the negotiation, the management, the positioning, then he is not available for the actual fight. But there are many times when Drishtadyumna would actually consult Arjuna about what to do. And of course, because Drishtadyumna was considered the person appointed to kill Dronacharya, who was also formidable, so he was appointed over there. So, when Duryodhana starts speaking, he says, Drishtva tu Pandava anikam yudham Duryodhana sata acharya mukusangamya raja vachinam abravit. So, Pandava anikam, the phalanx of the Pandavas he sees, and immediately he is very very confident initially that he is going to win the war, because he has 11 Lakshmanis, the Pandavas have only 7. So, in spite of this, when he sees the very systematic way in which the Pandava army has been arranged, he becomes a little alarmed. And he goes and speaks to Dronacharya. And then he says, Pashyaitam Panduputranam Acharya Mahatim Chamam Yudham Drupadaputrena Tava Shishyena Dhimata. Now one of the greatest fears for Duryodhana is the loyalty of the people on his side. Because to some extent, although he never admitted it, he knows that he is on the evil side, and he knows that the two most powerful warriors on his side are Bhishma and Drona, and he knows both of them are affectionate towards the Pandavas. He knows that Karna is completely inimical towards the Pandavas, but Karna is not there on the side right now for him. So that's why he's to incite Dronacharya, he is saying, Drupada Putrena Tava Shishyena Dhimata. So all of you know that story, that when Drupada was defeated at that time, Dronacharya almost insulted him. So Drupada did a yagya by which two personalities came, Drishtadyumna, who would kill Dronacharya, and Draupadi, who would be given in hand to that person who had defeated him. That was Arjuna. So he is saying, although Dronacharya knew that Drupada's son is going to kill me, still he was so broad-minded that he gave him training. And then when he gave him the training, he is reminding him, don't be so broad-minded now. Now that person is already there, he is on your enemy side. So whatever affection you have, please give it up and keep fighting. And then he starts speaking, Atra Shura Maheshvasha Drobhi Marjan Samayudhi Yudhano Viradasya Drupadasya Maharatha. So now he starts going into describing the various warriors. We won't go into all of them because it will take a long time. But he compares Bhima Arjun Samayudhi. So from his side, he is confident about these important personalities, Bhishma, Drona, then his powerful people and Karna. On the opposite side, he is especially fearful of Bhima and Arjuna. Because Bhima, he is himself going to deal with him, and Arjuna, he is afraid of him. He hopes Karna will deal with him. And then Yudhana, Virata, Yudhana, Satyaki, Virata, all these people are there. And then he goes on and describes several warriors on his side, on the opponent side. Asmakam tu, so this is verse 7 now. Asmakam tu vishishta ye tan nibodha dujottama nayaka mama sainyasya sangyatham tan bravimite. So after describing several warriors on the side of the Pandavas, now generally whenever the king is going to speak, not only the person who is speaking to is hearing, other warriors also come to hear what he is speaking. So because he has glorified the opponent army so much, he is fearing that his people may get discouraged. Therefore he says, now I will describe those warriors who are on my side. And then he starts, now he has a crisis. Whom should he mention first? So he thinks about it. Actually Bhishma is his commander, but Drona is also very veteran. So then he thinks that actually Bhishma is a very cultured person. So although he is the senior most, he knows that Brahmanas are respected more than Kshatriyas. So if I speak about Bhishma first, Drona may feel offended. But if I speak Bhishma first, Drona, if I speak Drona first, Bhishma will not be offended. Therefore, Bhavan Bhishmascha Karanascha. So although Karna is not there, Karna is very much there in his memory. Because he is depending on Karna. So Bhavan Bhishmascha Karanascha Krupascha Samitim Jaya. So he starts, all these are people who are always victor. Samitim Jaya. Ashwatthama Avikaranascha Saumadatti Tathaivacha.
The second verse Sanjay Vivacha is speaking now.
So after this
Sanjay is having kind of duplicity, not exactly duplicity, but he is thinking how the Dhritarashtra would feel, so that's why he is putting this word
like. No, this is what is actually happening over there. This is how Duryodhana is speaking.
Okay,
there are three levels now. Dhritarashtra asks the question, Sanjay starts answering, and Sanjay starts describing what Duryodhana is speaking. So now there is no Duryodhana Vacha separately, because Raja Vachanam Abravit, he spoke these words. So that special is not there separately as a phrase, that is included in one verse. So all this is being spoken by Duryodhana. And then after this, he speaks only briefly about his own soldiers, because he is eager that the battle should start. Annej bahava asha madarthe tyakta jeevitaha. And he says, he is hoping that, you know, all of these warriors should be committed to my side. So in order to encourage them, he is telling them that they are all ready to lay down their life for my side. So Chakravarti Pal says, actually, the super soul is speaking a prophecy through his mouth. You know, he is telling that those who are going to, they are all going to lay down their life. Nana asha. Sarve yuddha shabda. Actually, nobody survived. It is not just on the Kaurava side. Even on the Pandava side. Actually, there are very few. The only person who survived from the Kaurava side was Yutsu. Yutsu was the half-brother of the Pandavas, of the Kauravas, who was born through Dhritarashtra. When Dhritarashtra was waiting in the long pregnancy of Gandhari, he united with one of his maid servants. And through that, Yutsu was born. So Yutsu was not a person who approved of Duryodhana's evil ways. And that's why eventually he defected. Now, apart from that, from their side, only Kritavarman, Kripa and Ashwatthama survived. And from this side, the Pandavas, Krishna and Satyaki. That's all that survived. Because all the other survivors were killed by Ashwatthama at night. Now he says, he wants to compare. So he has told their warriors, our warriors, so 10th verse is the comparison. Aparyaptam tadasmakam balam bhima abhirakshitam paryaptam taidametesham balam bhishma abhirakshitam. So he is actually saying, from my side, my army is protected by Bhishma. Still he has to balance it, because he spoke Drona first earlier. So now he is saying, our army is protected by Bhishma. Bhishma is the commander. So the contrast is not there. He is not saying Dhrishtadyumna over there. He's saying Bhima, because he considered Bhima. See, Arjuna also has a little soft heart. But just like Duryodhana is very, very inimical, so from the Kaurava side, from the Pandava side, Bhima is the most inimical. He's the most bent on war. Therefore, he said, their army is protected by Bhima, and our army is protected by Bhishma. So he wants to inspire Bhishma to fight nicely. But then he uses two words over, aparyaptam and paryaptam. So aparyaptam. Now you know when the paryapta means sufficient. Now aparyapta, when the prefix a comes, sometimes it can emphasize or it can contradict. So purna, apurna. So there apurna means incomplete. So he is intending this aparyaptam with one intention. What is that intention? Actually he is saying, and actually their strength is insufficient. How can they fight? They can't fight with me. Because only Bhima is there. Bhima is so insignificant. Bhishma is so powerful. Our strength is sufficient. But another way of understanding why the aparyaptam can mean actually insufficient, or it can also mean immeasurable. That's like measurable, immeasurable. Here, the prefix increases the quantity. Durlabha, sudurlabha. Like that. So he is telling, so the Chakravarti Pal. Now here, this is one example of how different acharyas can give different meanings. So Baldev Vidyabhushan, Prabhupada follows Baldev Vidyabhushan here, and Baldev Vidyabhushan says that Aparyapta means insufficient. But Chakravarti Pal explains that aparyapta means immeasurable. Why is that? He says actually from the point of view of experience and expertise, Bhishma is much much more powerful than Bhima. But the essence of a warrior's fighting is his spirit. And as far as spirit is concerned, Bhima is much more committed than Bhishma. Bhishma never wanted the war. So, because Bhima is going to fight wholeheartedly, Bhishma is going to fight half-heartedly. Therefore, he is saying, actually their strength is much greater. Acharya explains that actually, this is to encourage Drona also. Although he is saying, our army is protected by Bhishma, but that will not be sufficient. That is immeasurable. So therefore, we will need more protection. And therefore, next verse is, Ayaneshu cha sarveshu yatha bhagam avastita. All of you, wherever you are, Bhishma eva abhirakshantu bhavanta sarva evahi. All of you, wherever you are situated, please stay in your positions and protect Bhishma. So he is encouraging others also. Please, you have to fight now. And all this is going on. The Bhishma is a diplomat. He has seen all this, he understands. He sees through all that Duryodhana is doing. And he says, what is the use of all this diplomacy? Anyway, you are going to die. So, let us start the war. Stop all this diplomacy. Therefore, he starts blowing his conscience. Now, Duryodhana thinks, oh, that means I have succeeded in inspiring him to start fighting. Therefore, it is, Tasya Sanjayan Harsham, Kuru Buddha Pitamaha. So, Tasya means that Duryodhana's Harsham, his delight increased. Why? Bhishma started blowing his flute. Sihanadamina Dyochai, like lion-like. And then all the warriors on the Kaurava side started blowing their conscience. And then immediately when they started blowing, so the blowing of the conscience indicates the war is going to start. So generally, the Vedic culture never allowed attacking an unprepared enemy. If you see what this idea of jihad and terrorism is, it's attack the unprepared and innocent enemies. But the Vedic understanding, Bhagavad Gita understanding is completely different. Of course, before both the armies start fighting, Bhishma and Dhrishtadyumna meet. And they say that these are the rules which are to be followed. So please commit that you will follow the rules. Dhrishtadyumna says, of course we'll follow the rules. And then he thinks a little bit and he says that we will follow the rules as long as all of you follow the rules. We won't be the first to break the rules of warfare. But if you break the rules first, then we will not follow the rules. So he makes that provision. And later on, the rules are broken several times by both sides. That happens. But still, it is not that anybody unprepared generally is attacked. So both sides now, this side they blow the conch shell and then immediately the other side also starts blowing the conch shell. And here, Lord Krishna first comes into view. So actually Krishna is coming into the picture in the Bhagavad Gita in verse 14. Tataha shvetair hayair yukte mahati syandane stitau madhava pandava shaiva divyau shankhau pradatmatau. Shvetair hayair means white horses were there. Mati sandhane, a great chariot. So Prabhupada goes into a lot of elaboration describing. Actually when Arjuna satisfied Agni in the Khanda forest, at that time he got the Gandiva and he got the chariot. So the Gandiva is imperishable and the chariot is such that it can go in any direction, anywhere. Just like Agni can burn everywhere. So like that, Gandiva, the chariot can go everywhere. There are several signs of auspiciousness will be there. So three are described over here. Two are described. First is Mahati Sandhanistha, white horses, big chariot and Divyau Shankhau. Divine, transcendental conscience. Now of course Krishna's conscience is transcendental because it is Krishna's paraphernalia. Because Arjuna is working for a transcendental purpose, so his conscience is also considered transcendental. See, Vedic culture is so personal that even the conscious have names. You know, so the next verses will describe the names of the different consciences of the different people. So, Panchajanyam Rishikesho Devadattam Dhananjaya पौंड्रम दद्मौ महाशंखम भीम कर्म वृकोदरः. सो एवरीबडी स्टार्ट्स ब्लेइंग देयर ओन कॉन्शियस. देवदत्त इज अर्जुनस कॉन्शियस. Now Prabhupada goes into a lot of nomenclature over here. If, for example, he'll explain why the word Madhava is used, why the word Rishikesh is used. So Vrukodaraha. Vrukodaraha is one who eats a lot. Udara, you know. Vruka means great. Udara is belly. Vrukodaraha. So we have Vrukasura. You know, big asura. Like Vrukodaraha. So he used to eat a lot. So That idea, that is not a negative glorification. That is the idea that if he eats a lot, it is not that he is eating and sleeping. He is a warrior. So he eats a lot means he has huge strength. And then, everybody starts now, all their conscience are described. Ananta Vijayam Raja Kunti Putro Yudhishthira. So like that it goes on. All of them describe their, this thing, their conscience. And now a very interesting thing happens. The tumulo abhinnadayam. Tumulo means, this is related with the English word, tumultus. So that's verse 9. Tumulo abhinnadayam. And then what happens? Now from the verse 20 onwards, Arjuna starts speaking. Arjuna comes in the, Arjuna is kapidhvajaha. So now it's interesting, what is this kapidhvajaha? Arjuna always had a chariot of standard of a monkey. And after the interaction of Bhima and Hanuman in the Himalayan mountains, Hanuman agreed to be present within the standard. So that means there is a flag which has a monkey insignia on it, and that has always been there. But Hanuman agreed to manifest through that. So it's like that the warriors would think of me that actually that monkey is roaring, is screaming. No matter how this monkey is screaming, they didn't know Hanuman was there actually, and Hanuman was screaming. So, now Arjuna starts speaking. So, we'll recite this verse. Arjuna Vacha. Can we recite together? Say it together. Sena Yoru Bhayor Madhye Tam Sthapayan Mechuta Yavadetan Nirikshaham Yodhu Kamana Vastitan Kairmaya Sahayodhavyam Asmin Rana Samudhyame. So, he spoke this, yeah? No. That's long ago, no? When they were in exile. In the last year of exile, they went to Badrikashram. So, Arjuna went to the heavens to do the pasya. Not in the last year, towards the end of the... last year was, of course, they were Gyatvas in Vira. Towards the end of their Vanvas. So, Arjuna went to the heavens. And the Pandavas went to Badrikashram. And from Badrikashram, to get that 1,000-petal lotus. Lotus had flown down from, with the river. The river was coming, Ganga comes down from the heavens. So, a lotus was floating over there. So, Gopal said, I want this lotus. So, then Bhima said, surely I'll go and get it. And he went up. That time he met Hanuman. That same story. Yeah, when he was going upward towards the heaven. That's when it happened. So, now, Senayor Ubhayor Madhye Ratham Sthapayam Yachita. Please, actually both sides are there, war is supposed to start. But he says, please, place me within the center. What? I want to see who is there to fight. Now, we may wonder, what is this, you know, what is the need for him? He knows who is there going to fight. But, you know, the Pandavas, they are so non-envious, so although they are Kshatriyas, you know, they are Vaishnavas ultimately. So they don't want to fight the war. And till the end, that's why even Krishna himself went as a Shantidut. So, okay, alright, the war is there. But how much is the fighting spirit? You know, Kairmayas, who has come and how much fighting spirit they have? I want to see that. So he comes in the middle. And now he starts describing. And then what happens? Krishna takes the chariot right in place in the front of Bhima, Bhishma and Drona. He places it right over there. So you know, actually if we desire to get tempted, then Krishna will arrange the temptation to right be there for us. So actually, from the we're talking from a metaphysical point of view, the Bhagavad Gita illustrates how by pratyaksha and anuman one gets bewildered. So Arjuna said, I want to see who is going to fight, who is there to fight. And he sees pratyaksha, and then, so now he'll start describing. My grandfather is there, my teacher is there, my father-in-laws are there, my father's brothers, sons, grandsons, so many people are there, how can I fight with them? So he actually, first is, I want to see. And then Krishna says, okay, see, Pashyaitan. So he says, the whole thing starts with Krishna, Arjuna saying, Pashyaitan, I want to see. And Krishna says, please see. So if you want to see, if you have so much faith in your eyes, then you can see. So, now it is not that pratyaksha is wrong. Obviously, Arjuna is not going to close his eyes and fight the war. He has to use pratyaksha. But the idea is that if pratyaksha takes us away from Shabda, if we rely on pratyaksha more than we rely on Shabda, then it is a problem. So now Arjuna's pratyaksha is described in the first how many verses? So he's describing over here till 27. His pratyaksha is described. And then from the effect of pratyaksha, what is the effect of pratyaksha? He starts becoming weakened. And then he starts doing anuman. Oh, if this war happens, this will happen. If this happens, this will happen. This will happen, this will happen. And then he loses all his determination to fight. So, now there are several symptoms. So actually, the Bhagavad Gita is starts a very intensely emotional situation. First of all, the event of brothers and cousins fighting itself is emotional. But you look at the symptoms that are there, which Arjuna exhibits. So let's recite these verses together. From 28 onwards. Drishtvemam, together. 28 verses. Drishtvemam svajanam krishna yujutsum samupasthitam. Siddhanti mama gatrani mukham cha parishushyati. So siddhanti mama gatrani, my limbs are trembling. Parishushyati, my mouth is drying up. Then he says, Vepatuscha sharire me roma harshascha jayate. Gandhi vamshram sate hastat kvakchaiva paridhayate. Vepatuscha sharire me, my whole body is trembling. Roma harshascha jayate. My Romaharsha. Now Romanja Kampa Shutaranga Bhajo. So Prabhupada explains that the hairs stand in two situations. One is ecstasy, the other is fear. So Arjuna is obviously not in ecstasy. Therefore he is in great fear. But he says, fear can also be because of two situations. Fear is because of loss of one's own life, and fear can also be because of loss of life of one who is very dear to us. So Arjuna is not fearful because he thinks I will die. He's thinking, oh, my beloved ones, I'll kill him. So Arjuna's emotions are not out of cowardice. They're out of compassion. Kandivam sramsate hastat. That my Kandiva is slipping from my hand. We know that Arjuna has taken a while. Nobody can make me put down my Kandiva. But here, pratyaksha praman can make him put down the Kandiva. He loses determination completely. Tvakchaiva paridhayate. You know, we take a vow, I will always chant 16 rounds. But if we depend too much on pratyaksha, we will start thinking, what is the use of all this? You know, let's put aside the feedback, do something practical in life. Tvakchaiva paridhayate. My skin is burning. And then, Nachachaknomi masthatum brahmati vache mevana. My mind has started wandering. Actually, in a battlefield, nobody's mind will wander. But his mind is wandering because he is not knowing what to do. Nimittani cha pashyami viparitani keshava. Viparitani, opposite of exactly what I want, I am seeing. So now, Prabhupada gives an amazing purport here. He says that actually, you know, we are all self-centered. We are all selfish. And at a calculation of selfishness, this is good for me, this is bad for me. You know, we will come to a situation where both options will be bad. And see, when we say frustration means what? I am frustrated. If there is one good option, one bad option, there is no frustration. Because I will obviously take the good option. But when both options seem to be bad, or all options seem to be bad, then there is frustration. So, at a selfish calculation, sometimes one option may be bright, one option may be dark. But eventually a situation comes when all options appear dark. And at that time, the only way we can find a bright way is when we rise from selfishness to selflessness. So then, that's what Krishna is going to do to Arjuna. Krishna is going to raise his consciousness so that his calculations become exactly opposite. So we will, we will not go over all the verses. I'll just tell you. So there are basically five reasons which Arjuna gives for not fighting. So, you can remember his background. Said fee. C is compassion. So compassion. He says, oh, how can all these soldiers, my own beloved, how can I kill them? Nakangshe vijayam Krishna. This was his name. I don't desire. I don't want to kill all of them. 32-35 will describe the next one. Enjoyment. He says, how can I enjoy? First compassion is, oh, I don't want to kill all of them. Enjoyment is, oh, how will I enjoy if all my relatives are killed? Then, destruction of family traditions, which he'll describe from 39 onwards. 39 to 42. No, 43 describes that. And then 37-38 he describes fear of sinful reactions. And then in the next chapter, 2.6 he'll describe indecision. So yeah, there are four factors which make him feel I should not fight, and one factor means I don't know what to do. And at the end of it all, so a lot of verses go on, but we see now Arjuna doesn't have any really good option. He can't just fight because he feels, how can I kill my relatives? If he doesn't fight, he gives one option to Arjuna. He says, I know if one party doesn't fight, the other party fights. What is going to happen? The party which doesn't fight will get slaughtered. He says, I feel being slaughtered is better. So Arjuna is not afraid of death. He is afraid of making a wrong choice. He is afraid of making a wrong decision because that will lead to wrong consequences. That's why he says, where is that verse? The 45th second last verse of the chapter. Yadi mam apritikaram ashastram shastrapane dhritarashtra rane hanyus tanme kshematram bhavet. So, it's not coward. He says, even if I am killed, I don't mind. I don't want to kill them. Why? Yadraj sukhalobhena. How can I do such a sinful activity? So, there is a lot of thought flow which goes on. But basically, it is what? You know, he is anticipating what Krishna may speak. And he says, but if you don't fight, so he says, but don't you want the kingdom? He says, what do I want the kingdom? I am not a greedy person. I can live peacefully. I can live without a kingdom. He says, no, even if you don't want the kingdom, they will kill you. Therefore, you should kill them. I say, better that I be killed rather than I killing them. And at the end of the Bhagavad, what happens? He puts aside his bow. So, that's the last verse. Now again, so actually the narrative, you have to be a little careful. First, Sanjay spoke some things. Sanjay is speaking throughout. Then Sanjay tells what Arjuna is speaking. And now the narrative comes back to Sanjay speaks. Sanjay says that evam uktva Arjuna sankhe rathopasthe upavishan visujya sasaram chapam shokasam vignamanasaha. With sorrow, he puts his bow aside and he can no longer fight. So, sometimes, you know, if you have movies or you have a serial in television, so they have what is called cliffhanger endings. You know what is a cliffhanger ending? That is there is a fight between the villain and the hero. Villain has bitten the hero and the hero has fallen from a mountain and is holding on to a cliff. And continued next week. Hey, what is going to happen now? So it's like that. Arjuna has put aside his bow. So there's a cliffhanger ending. What will happen next? So we'll see in the next class. Srimad Bhagavad Gita ki, Shri Prabhupada ki, Gaur Bhakta Vrinda ki, Dai Gaur Premanande. Yes, tu? I'll talk about this tomorrow. It's very, actually, Prabhupada generally talks about things from two ways. No, Prabhupada doesn't focus when he is analyzing who is right and who is wrong. He focuses on what we can learn. So that's why in one purport he will say that Arjuna is so compassionate, so sensitive. He is in the mode of goodness. And that's why he is capable of receiving spiritual knowledge. And so from the point of view of qualification for receiving spiritual knowledge, Arjuna is qualified. But then in the next 2.1 purport only he will say that lamentation, illusion and fear of death, all these are signs of ignorance. So, from the point of spiritual knowledge, Arjuna is acting ignorant. In that sense, he is saying he is sentimental, he is this, he is that, he may speak negatively. But from the point of view of qualification, yes, he is qualified. So, Prabhupada speaks both ways. Yes, he is compassionate, he is soft-hearted. So, that means he is qualified for spiritual knowledge. But does he have spiritual knowledge right now? No, he doesn't have. Is this clear? See, no, see, there is goodness, passion, ignorance. All three are in Maya. But the Maya of goodness is relatively conducive for Krishna consciousness. Ultimately, one has to take the decision to surrender to Krishna. But that decision is much more easy to take if one is in goodness. And if one takes it, it's much more easy to practice. If somebody already has a habit of regulated eating, regulated sleeping, no bad habits, for him to practice Krishna consciousness is much easier. It's like, Prabhupada gives the example, dry wood, wet wood and water. So, you know, ultimately dry wood, wet wood or water, none of them are illuminated. The spark has to come. But the spark comes, which is the most easy to illuminate? That is dry wood. So dry wood is like goodness, wet wood is like passion, and water or land completely, not water, land I think Prabhupada uses. Land is like ignorance. So you know you have to light so many matchsticks, and somehow the purple person ignorance will start. Otherwise, other than someone goodness, quickly he will start. So in that sense Prabhupada is saying that he is qualified. So from the material point of view, goodness is the best. And Prabhupada explained that he is qualified. But that does not mean that the dry wood is on fire. The dry wood is still not on fire. So like that, he is still ignorant from the spiritual point of view. But he is in a position where he can be easily enlightened. Okay. I think we should stop here. We will talk later if you don't mind. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.